Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, the Finance Minister discusses the official cash rate cut to 1%. Police reduced numbers at Ihumātau after meeting organisers, and thousands farewell Sir Brian Lahore on a pitch he used to play on.
He was able to focus so completely on the task at hand that he could roll his motorbike on himself while grappling with a sheep in a flat paddock and not lose his grip on the animal.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, the Abortion Reform Bill breezed through its first reading in Parliament, 94-23, but the Justice Minister isn't under any illusion the rest of the readings will be as easy. The public will now get their say on abortion law reform. The Select Committee, set up specifically for this bill, is women only, but has MPs who are both for and against abortion reform. ACT's David Seymour will have a more informal role. In the background of all of this has been Winston Peters' 11th hour revelation that New Zealand First is now calling for a referendum on abortion. That decision blindsided both his own MP, Tracy Martin, who insists referendum talks had never been raised, and Mr. Little, who's also been in the dark. On Thursday night, Ms. Martin visibly struggled to explain the previous 48 hours.
I was going to speak about Beverly Williams, my mother's birth mother. I've talked about Beverly in this house before. We never knew Beverly. My mother doesn't really remember Beverly. Beverly left her 2-year-old daughter and 5-year-old son in 1943. And it took well into the 1980s for us to find out what happened to her. But that story will have to wait. Because, as often happens in this place, Mr. Speaker, events has moved on, and so this speech must change.
On Friday morning, the Justice Minister Andrew Little joined Susie Ferguson in the Wellington Morning Report studio.
Blindsided by the referendum call, is it clear to you what happened?
We know that on Tuesday, just before Christian time on Tuesday, I was told the New Zealand First Caucus had indicated they wished for there to be a referendum about the abortion bill if we got to that stage of the proceedings through the House. So that was their call. I was told that that was what they wanted.
But is it understandable to you that that was not raised at all during the talks with Tracy Martin, and she says it wasn't raised with her through caucus?
Yeah, I mean, I engaged a lot with Tracy over this. She was the point person for New Zealand First, obviously dealing with the Greens as well, and latterly conversations with National MPs. But the most intensive discussions I had were with Tracy Martin, and it was literally kind of clause by clause. We went through the whole thing, and occasionally she had to go back to her caucus, but there was never any indication that a referendum was being sought.
Okay, so you would have anticipated, considering she had to go back to her caucus during that process, that if this was something on the table, somewhere along the line someone might have mentioned that.
Well, not just from Tracy. You remember this goes through a cabinet committee process and cabinet. Mm. There are four New Zealand First MPs who are cabinet ministers. No one at any of those other former stages had raised the idea that maybe this would be subject to a referendum.
Do you feel hijacked by Winston Peters on this?
No, not at all. Look, they are their own sovereign party. They have their own policies and they make their own decisions.
So, but would it not just be good manners to say that that was going to be a bottom line?
It would have been helpful if earlier that had been raised, so that could have been factored in. In any event, look, I think the numbers yesterday indicate that there are a lot of MPs right across the House who do want to see change. Mm. As I've indicated, I think that those numbers won't necessarily survive right through every other stage of when the bill goes through the House.
I suppose the other side of this, though, is should Tracy Martin have known that a referendum would be on the table for New Zealand First? So has she been undercut by her leader or not?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to talk to her about that. Mm. I mean, I deal with the person I'm required to
sure.
deal with.
Sure. Unfortunately, she wouldn't come on Morning Report this morning. So, you know, I wonder, considering you've had a lot to do with her during this process, what your observation is.
Well, she is a person of absolute and utter integrity, and she's a very straight shooter. She is a delight to work with. I regard her as a highly trusted New Zealand First member to deal with. And that's why we were able to get where we did with this piece of legislation.
But for this to happen at the 11th hour, how damaging is it to the coalition relationship? Because this is not the first time that you've had the rug pulled out from under you.
Look, it doesn't have to be damaging at all. It is what it is. It's happened. Look, we have a coalition agreement and we carry on. We've got a government to run and a country to run. So
it doesn't have to be damaging, but there's an indication there that there is the possibility that it could be.
Well, I mean, for whatever happened, New Zealand First indicated very late in the piece, after the legislation had been lodged and announced and on the cusp of its first reading, that they wished it to be subject to a referendum. I mean, they, like any other MP during the Committee of the Whole House stage, are free to put up any amendment they want. Mm. There will be a lot of amendments. I think some MPs in the debate yesterday indicated that they would be putting things up. Let them do that. But they stand in line with everybody else and they've got to win the numbers to do that.
Were you surprised with the numbers?
I was actually. After we announced the detail of the legislation on Monday, I had indications from various MPs right across the House in the last few days indicating their support. So my sense was the support wasn't going to be by a small margin, but I was surprised at the margin by which it succeeded its first reading.
Were you surprised at any of the people who opposed it?
No, and I listened carefully to most of those speeches, and I thought that they were thoughtful. There wasn't anything there that surprised me, and there are MPs like citizens who bring their very deep-seated faith-based views about it. I understand that, I get that, and those views were expressed in the debate in Parliament.
What about the Select Committee? It's an all-women Select Committee. David Seymour also has some sort of role on it. Just very briefly, can you talk us through how that has come about?
Well, the way we had set it up, Cabinet agreed, is that every party would be represented on it. David Seymour was to be offered a seat. He said he didn't wish to be formally part of it, but he did wish to have, as every MP does on any Select Committee, the right to observe, but he also wanted to ask questions, and to get to ask questions, the whole committee has to agree. I'm pretty sure that will happen, but in him relinquishing his formal spot, the National Party will pick up an extra spot, but he will be there.
Any indication around how you've got two of the supporters of the bill as the chair and the deputy chair? How important is it to hear the diversity of views?
That is, and I think one of the National Party's other members, and in fact one of the Labour members, Anahila, they are both opponents of the legislation. So I think there is a good mix on the committee.
The Justice Minister, Andrew Little, on Morning Report. As you heard, the Abortion Reform Bill passed its first reading 94-23, but there was plenty of drama outside of the debating chamber in the days leading up to the vote. RNZ's political editor Jane Patterson also joined Susie Ferguson.
It's been quite a week of drama, the stoush that ended up with Winston Peters accusing Labour of acting in bad faith.
That's right, Susie. So the bill and the provisions were announced by Andrew Little and the Prime Minister at post-cabinet on Monday. And RNZ did a follow-up package, an interview with Tracy Martin, where she said that there would be no referendum. And, of course, that's a very regular position of New Zealand First that does like to call for a referendum or hold them on contentious or conscience issues. Now, we understand there was a relatively fractious caucus meeting the next day when other MPs thought that she had basically jumped the gun by stating so definitively that there would be no referendum when the caucus really hadn't discussed this. So Tracy Martin caught in the middle a bit. She'd been conducting negotiations with Andrew Little and at no point had they discussed referendum. The caucus had not brought up their desire or any members' desire for a referendum up until that point. So at that stage, one of the MPs, Derek Ball, indicated he would be putting forward an amendment to the bill for a referendum. Tracy Martin had to go and talk to the Prime Minister's office, talk to Andrew Little's office before everyone came over to the bridge, and that was when over to question time. And that's when Andrew Little said, look, first I've heard of it, and he was alluding to the discussions that he and Tracy Martin had. So all a bit untidy, and actually leading to an interview with Winston Peters, the New Zealand First leader, where he accused Labour of acting in bad faith on Sky News Australia.
Yeah, so this is, as you're saying, politically very messy. It's not the first time that Andrew Little has been on the end of this from Winston Peters. How much tension is this going to be causing within the coalition government?
Everyone's downplaying it. Winston Peters was playing nice in the House yesterday, saying that he hadn't been blindsided at all by the abortion issue, as he had claimed on Sky News Australia, because it had been flagged by Jacinda Ardern and the election campaign. The Law Commission had put out a very substantial piece on abortion law reform. So everyone was sort of downplaying it when it was put to them that it could be damaging. But again, it always raises speculation. It always raises commentary about dysfunction, miscommunication, which never looks good for the governing arrangements. But look, you heard Andrew Little on this morning saying, look, everything's fine. The main relationship with this is between Andrew Little and Tracy Martin, that both agree was conducted in good faith. So I think we had a bit of a reaction from New Zealand First, partly probably driven by their concern that they would be seen as inconsistent on not calling for a referendum on abortion, where, of course, we've had one for euthanasia, for cannabis, other big sort of social changes. So I think that's probably what drove their response. But I think everything will settle down now and the bill will go through, continue to go through the House with the focus very much on the debates and the issues around the law changes itself.
As for the referendum, though, is that amendment, should it be made, looks likely to be made, is that one that is going to stick and become part of it, do you think?
It doesn't look like it will. This is a different situation from euthanasia, where, for example, New Zealand First negotiated its support in return for a referendum. Now, this is a different one. This is just where one party will put forward an amendment, and Jacinda Ardern and Andrew Little have already signalled very strongly they do not want a referendum, because, of course, that would mean that voters would have three referenda when they arrived at the polling booth next year, and there is certainly no appetite from Labour. And while it's a conscience vote, signals from the leaders are very effective in terms of other MPs either voting or not for a referendum. I'd be very surprised if that referendum amendment was to be successful when it comes up during the committee stages of the House.
RNZ's political editor Jane Patterson on Friday's Morning Report. With the cost of borrowing at an all-time low, the government and the country are being told to seize the moment and spend to help boost the economy. The Reserve Bank slashed the official cash rate to a record low of 1% on Wednesday, citing low business and consumer confidence and slowing global trade. Hamish Cardwell filed this for Thursday's Morning Report.
The Reserve Bank Governor Adrian Orr has a clear message. He wants people to take advantage of cheap money to borrow and spend.
You know, the good old phrase, monetary policy always needs friends. At this point, it needs friends around all parts of the economy, consumers to be comfortable, businesses to invest, and of course, government to be spending. Our nervousness, and you know, it feels quite unusual for a central banker to be saying this, our nervousness is that expenditure can't happen quick enough.
Stephen Selwood from Infrastructure New Zealand says there's plenty of desperately needed spending for the government to get on with.
We're seeing congestion in our growing cities. We're seeing water contamination infecting our drinking water systems. We're seeing discharges in the fresh water bodies that are unacceptable. We've got major risks on climate change threats looking into the future. Now's the opportunity to be addressing all of those issues.
Retail banks were quick to pass on the full cut to floating mortgage rates, with the new average about 5.2%. But there were smaller reductions in fixed loans. Housing developer Matthew Horncastle from Williams Corporation says it's all good news for first home buyers and also for investors.
The main thing that's happened that I think is going to be really big for the property industry is just the margin difference between rental income and getting your mortgage. So let's say by the end of the year you can get a mortgage at 3%. And without working very hard, you can go find a property with a 6% rent return. And so that's going to make that investment property extremely attractive.
And for this Wellington landlord, it may mean a nice surprise for the tenants.
It'll just cut the interest that I'm paying over all and I suppose make it a bit more profitable, so I'm not so worried about charging more rent.
But the flip side to cheaper borrowing is lower returns for savers. Mac Welch from Grey Power estimates some pensioners will be out of pocket by as much as $76 a week, a big chunk of income.
It's all very well for the people that are on sort of $150,000 a year and they're bringing home sort of $1,700 a week. $76 is no big deal. They probably spend that in Friday night drinks. But people on these level of incomes, they don't have that luxury. And $76 out of their pay is the difference between running a heater over the cold of the winter.
And this Wellington woman, whose husband is retired, is worried what it means for their income.
Well, I'd probably end up having to work 60 or 70 hours a week rather than my standard 45, just to survive or do anything.
But whether you're a spender or a saver, there are probably more cuts in store. Infometrics economist Gareth Kiernan is predicting the Reserve Bank will move again before the end of the year. But he's worried the bank won't have any levers left to pull if there's an international shock.
The biggest problem we have at the moment is that there's not a lot of ammunition left in the tank if something goes really wrong overseas, you know, particularly in terms of that US-China trade situation. Obviously more talk about tariffs coming on.
The Reserve Bank will make its next interest rate announcement on September the 25th.
Hamish Cardwell with that report from Morning Report. And joining Corin Dan on the program was the Finance Minister, Grant Robertson. Corin asked him if the rate cut was a sign of impending trouble.
It's a sign that the Reserve Bank governor believes that he wants to get ahead of the curve. You know, he's got responsibilities in terms of the remit that he has around controlling inflation and maximum sustainable employment. His belief, I think, is that if he didn't act, he would have trouble meeting those targets over the coming months. So this is not about an immediate crisis in the economy. It's about the fact that, yes, growth has slowed. Yes, we need to make sure we do everything we can, both with monetary and fiscal policy, to make sure we stimulate the economy.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, and I talked to Paul Goldsmith about this as well. And the Reserve Bank governor made it clear he wants the government to step up here in terms of what it can do with spending to create demand in the economy. Will you bring forward infrastructure projects that are sitting on your books now to also help meet that concern that's in the future?
Well, you've got to be careful to say exactly what the governor did say or the Monetary Policy Committee did say yesterday. They said that government spending will assist demand. They actually said that. The point is we've already done it, Corin. In the budget, we increased our operating spending to $3.8 billion per annum. We've got $10 billion worth of capital spending that we've agreed on. And so we are actually doing the work to stimulate the economy.
Okay, no, fair point. But I've got to pick you up on that because I think Treasury in the budget said that the fiscal impulse, which is the terminology for the amount of money coming in from the government into the economy, would be near zero at 2020.
It's a significant improvement on what was forecast and certainly a significant improvement on where the previous government had been. We could get into a debate about how that fiscal impulse has worked out, but let's be clear, we've got a significant amount of investment going in. We're building schools, we're building hospitals. We've got $17 billion going into transport over the next 4 years, far in excess of what was originally planned.
Sure. But the argument is that we've got an iceberg coming at us from a China-US trade war. The Reserve Bank governor's gone, right, I need to take some action to get ahead of this. He's hinting, if that's the right word, that maybe the government also needs to take more action. So will you do more to ensure that we do not go into recession? Get in there early.
Look, we will continue to keep an eye on what's happening in the world, and I think you're absolutely right to highlight the fact that, you know, we are in highly uncharted territory, to use the words of the ASB, when it comes to the US-China trade war. So obviously we keep an eye on that. The point I'm making is we've already taken the decision to stimulate the economy and to spend significantly more. We've done that at the same time as balancing the books, so I'm pretty pleased about that. But we understand the fact that the government's got a role in terms of fiscal policy. It's why we're spending record amounts of money in health, education, transport, because we do understand this. The bank and the governor have recognised that yesterday, and this is what should happen. Monetary and fiscal policy working together. We'll keep an eye on the ongoing international situation and continue to move if we need to. But the point is, we've already done this. The Reserve Bank did their bit yesterday. Let's let that play out while we monitor the situation.
But the danger is, and the Reserve Bank governor made this point yesterday. Timing is tricky here, isn't it? And no one's saying it's an easy job. You've got to somehow time it so that the money, that the extra money that a government might put in comes in at just the right time in order to prevent us falling into, you know, the economy stalling, because nobody wants that.
No, absolutely nobody wants that. And as I say, that's what we did in the budget. Bear in mind, going into the budget in May, we were to have $2.4 billion per annum of new operating spending. I lifted that to $3.8 billion per annum for precisely this reason. So let's let that play out. Let's let the leavers do that. But we obviously understand it. It's not correct, as Mr. Goldsmith said, to say that there were projects that were ready to go. There weren't. They weren't funded. We've got $17 billion worth of transport funding going out over the next 4 years. You're seeing that with the development around regional roads, around rail. So it is happening. You're right. It's tricky. We keep an eye on that international situation. But I do think we've got to pause here for a second, Corin. The New Zealand economy continues to outperform Australia, Canada, Japan, the Euro area, the US. We are doing well. Our growth rates are actually ahead of there. We've got good employment growth, unemployment down, wages rising. The New Zealand economy still has strong fundamentals, but the world is in a lower growth era.
I guess the point is, and this to use sort of a Reserve Bank, central bank language, are you prepared to just do whatever it takes if you start to see signs that things are slowing down faster, that the trade war is hurting earlier? What your message to the business community is important here, because business confidence is weak, business investment is weak. Are you, as the finance minister, prepared to do whatever it takes, like the Reserve Bank governor is signalling, to ensure we do not go into recession?
This is a great time for businesses to invest in New Zealand. It's a time where they have got low interest rates. We continue to have a stable economy overall. So we will continue to monitor the situation. I believe we're taking action to stimulate the economy. That's exactly what we did in the budget. That budget kicked in on the 1st of July. Let's let that roll out. Of course, we continue to monitor the situation, but we are a government that understands that actually government spending plays a stimulus role, and that's what we're doing.
The Finance Minister Grant Robertson on Thursday's Morning Report. The Prime Minister says the government remains fully committed to the Royal Commission into Abuse in State Care, despite the shock resignation of its chair. Sir Anand Sachinan has led the inquiry since its establishment 18 months ago, but he announced on Tuesday he'll step down in November, saying the workload has increased markedly since the inquiry scope was widened to include faith-based institutions. He will take up a four-year term as Chancellor of Te Whare Wānanga o Waikato, or Waikato University, replacing the former Prime Minister Jim Bolger. Our reporter Katie Scotcher has the story.
Sir Anand Sachinand has been in the job for just 18 months, but he says now is the time to go.
I've taken the opportunity at the age of 75, knowing that the survivors are being cared for, knowing that I have good colleagues. This is a sensible opportunity for the chairship of the Royal Commission to change.
Sir Anand says he made the decision to leave after his 75th birthday earlier this year. He says he signed up to the job thinking it would be part-time, but when the inquiry scope was widened to include faith-based institutions and the timeline of the commission extended, his workload increased significantly.
I don't think there's been any week since the beginning of last year where I've had 3 days, it's usually been four, and most often five, and it has been a significant piece of effort.
Since it was established, the Royal Commission has been heavily criticised for employing a gang member into one of its top jobs, and for the way it is operating. Sir Anand says the inquiry has learnt from those mistakes.
We have taken on board what has happened, have worked out why it has happened, and if there has been a mistake or something wrong occur, there have been steps put in place to fix that.
Mervyn Singham, the inquiry's executive director, says those challenges have nothing to do with Sir Anand's resignation.
We have faced a number of challenges, and what we've been doing is listening, learning, and incorporating what we've heard by way of feedback into the way we do things. And we will be doing that right until the end of the inquiry.
The minister responsible for the Royal Commission, Tracy Martin, says the resignation shouldn't come as a surprise.
This was going to always be one of the longest inquiries that New Zealand was going to see. So, you know, we will see people who come on, do a really good job for us, but then for circumstances in their own lives need to move on to something else.
Ms Martin says she hopes Sir Anand's departure won't discourage survivors from contributing to the inquiry.
I'm confident that Sir Anand has led the process up to this point so that when the open public hearings begin, that we now have a Royal Commission that people can be confident in.
The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, says the resignation won't affect the government's commitment to the inquiry.
It's likely that the Royal Commission into abuse in state care will take some time, and that means we may see personnel changes from time to time. What's important is that we continue their work, and that's absolutely our commitment.
The government now has until November to find a new chair for the Royal Commission. Sir Anand will attend the inquiry's first public hearing in October, when expert witnesses will give evidence. He will be paid by the inquiry until his departure and will not receive a payout.
Katie Scotcher with that report from Tuesday's Checkpoint programme. On Friday morning, armed police in Christchurch were continuing their manhunt for fugitive Liam Strickland. Strickland was being sought in connection to the hit-and-run death of Dean Amies in the suburb of New Brighton on Wednesday night. He is considered dangerous. On Thursday night, armed police cordoned off two roads in the suburb of Woolston and arrested three people. Mike Johnson is the acting Canterbury District Commander. He joined Corin Dan on Friday's morning report.
What is the latest overnight and what can you tell us about these arrests last night?
So, firstly, overnight we did cordon an address and there have been three arrests made. There was a vehicle that needed to be stopped and checked and that didn't stop for us, and we subsequently made three arrests after cordoning an address. We're still looking for Liam Strickland this morning, obviously intensively looking for him in relation to the death of the 2 days ago.
Were the arrests last night connected to your search?
The vehicle was something that we were interested in, and the actions of the occupants and other matters were the reasons that those people were arrested at the time.
You had a pretty extensive operation yesterday with a number of properties raided. Can we expect to see something similar today?
We'll continue the investigation, Corin. We are looking to safely speak to Liam Strickland, obviously. In relation to this death, it's very important to us that we do that. We've got an amount of information coming in from the public and others, which we're actively actioning, and we will continue to do that. We want to speak to Mr. Strickland in relation to this death, obviously, and that's our aim to do that, as I said, safely.
What can you tell us about Mr. Strickland? He's reportedly on bail, and is that right?
Well, he's got three warrants for his arrest, Mr. Strickland, and has removed Ian Bail bracelet earlier, so he's of great interest to us for those matters, obviously, but and then he's as a result of us looking for him, we've had this death, this sad death, and our thoughts go out to the family of the deceased, and we're working very closely with them. It's our aim, as I said, to bring Mr. Strickland in and have a conversation and take the appropriate action from there.
You have armed police. Why have you needed to take that move?
We have information that Mr. Strickland's a risk to us. He's avoiding arrest actively, and we, as I say, I need to keep us and our public safe, and the staff have been routinely armed for the last 24 hours so that they can achieve that purpose. Unfortunately, we haven't been successful to date, but we will continue until we are.
Is this a gang-related issue?
This is an issue where this person is a gang member, but is it a gang-related issue is a different question because...
Sure, I'll rephrase that. I mean, are you worried that he's perhaps being protected by the gangs? I mean, is that a concern?
Look, our interest is speaking to Mr. Strickland and taking the appropriate action in relation to the homicide investigation. In relation to he is a member of a gang, as I said to you, and it's we will be speaking with his and are speaking with associates and people who are linked to him so that we can get him in the right place so we can have that conversation.
What makes you think that he's still in Canterbury?
We have no information to suggest that he has left Canterbury at this point in time. We'll continue to take the appropriate action, as I said to you, Corin. The bottom line is we're still getting information that suggests he's still in Canterbury.
A number of the raids and the police action were in East Christchurch. So are you of the view that that is where he might be?
So he certainly has links to that area, and that's the reason that we're in that area. But we're keeping an open mind, and we would encourage anyone with information about where Liam is to give us a ring so that we can bring this to a conclusion, as I said, safely for all concerned.
The gun issue, frontline officers, it hasn't been that long since it was... since they were carrying them post the mosque shootings and this sort of thing, has the threshold lowered? I mean, for you to put out that directive?
Not at all. Not at all. We district commanders and the commissioners made this very clear. The district commanders have the ability to arm staff to make sure that they're safe. If you think about it, Corin, when people are moving away from a serious event, I'm asking our officers to go towards it and deal with things. And we need to make sure that we're equipping them properly. It's my view that in this situation as it exists currently, that threshold, and it is a very high bar, is met.
And there's no need to widen that from Canterbury at the moment in terms of frontline officers having firearms?
Not at this point in time. If we have information that suggest that, obviously we will consider that very carefully, but not at this point in time.
That's the acting Canterbury District Police Commander Mike Johnson on Morning Report. A Whanganui woman who strangled her 13-year-old granddaughter with a necktie has been spared life imprisonment. Lorraine Smith was sentenced on Wednesday to 12 years in jail for the March murder. She will be eligible for parole after 6 years. The sentencing judge commented that Smith had devoted her life to helping her family, and that burden had taken a tremendous toll. Charlotte Cook filed this for Wednesday's Checkpoint program.
Lorraine Smith killed her granddaughter Carlise on March 15th at their Whanganui home. Today, the High Court in Wellington was told Smith asked Carlise to go to their sleepout. She didn't want her brother to hear the struggle when she strangled Carlise with a necktie. Smith sobbed through the sentencing as Justice Frances Cook said she'd been described as a grandmother who'd turned herself inside out trying to help her family. He says she suffered from depression and anxiety and had come under significant stress while looking after her grandchildren and severely disabled son. Justice Cook says she became overwhelmed and suffered carer burnout.
Ms. Smith has devoted her life to caring for her family to the detriment of her own health and welfare. The burden of doing so has taken a tremendous toll, and the pressures have mounted to the point that Ms. Smith has taken the life of one of those she had committed her life to caring for.
Justice Frances Cook says Smith's life had been marked by hardship and difficult family circumstances. He says sentencing Smith to life in prison for murder would have been unjust, given the situation. As the case was stood down, Smith wailed as she left the courtroom. There were no dry eyes in the public gallery either. The family left with their heads down, clutching onto each other. The chief executive of Grandparents Raising Grandchildren Trust, Kate Bundle, says it's a tragic case, but the judge's sentence was appropriate.
I think the judge got it right. There clearly was intentional act on the part of the grandmother. It is incredibly sad that she got to that point where it all just became too much and she made that decision to kill her granddaughter. On the one hand, they've lost their daughter, their sibling, their sister. It's incredibly difficult and sad for them that they've lost Kaylee, but they've also lost their beloved grandmother, who has been quite a central figure in their life.
Kate Bundle says, sadly, this situation raises awareness of the severity of carer burnout. Members of her family had reportedly urged Smith to change her guilty plea and consider a charge of manslaughter due to her mental health problems. Lorraine Smith's cousin, Albert Thompson, told RNZ the family are hurting for her because of everything she's been through, but they love her and will continue to support her. But Crown Prosecutor Michelle Wilkinson-Smith says they argued for the defendant to get life in prison, with a reduced minimum period of time spent in prison due to her age and situation.
the family, understandably, are just at a complete loss to understand how this could have happened, because the defendant has been a loving, caring grandmother and a member of their whānau for them, and the Crown accepted it's completely out of character.
However, Michelle Wilkinson-Smith says the Crown had to consider whether Smith's circumstances were that dissimilar to those of other families.
Yes, her situation was very hard, but many people are in that situation, and we have to be careful not to excuse that, because while she was in a hard situation, of course, the children in her care were in a hard situation as well. I mean, they needed her care. She was the adult.
Lorraine Smith's defence lawyer, Peter Brosnahan, told the court that whatever sentence she received today would pale in comparison to the fact she has to live out the rest of her days knowing what she's done.
Charlotte Cook with that report from Checkpoint. And Dr. Liz Gordon is a former MP and the president of Pillars, which supports children of prisoners. She says she recently contacted Smith in Rimutaka Prison and pleaded with her to change her guilty plea. She spoke to Alex Perrottet on Checkpoint from Singapore Airport on Wednesday and said she was relieved that Smith could be out of prison in 6 years.
Well, the first thing is it's not life in prison, which is generally the minimum for murder. So that was our first goal, to make sure that she didn't get a life imprisonment when she decided to plead guilty to murder. 12 years, it's a high manslaughter. And the judge talks about why he thought that was. But the best news, Alex, is she'll be out in 6 years, because she won't appeal this. She's determined to take her sentence. So she'll be out in 6 years, she'll be 65 going on 66, and there's hope for her for a reasonable end of life, and, you know, hopefully her health issues will be fixed up in prison, although, you know, they aren't always. But I hope she's treated well in prison, and she'll come out and be able to spend time with her whānau.
Liz, can you take us through what piqued your interest in this case? Why did you take it up and even approach Lorraine when she was in prison?
Oh, look, because the story was, as reported in the media, was just so horrific. This woman who basically given all her life for her children, then all her life to her grandchildren, and then in a moment snapped and killed Callis and was still loved by her whānau, was determined to punish herself to the max by pleading guilty to murder, when it seemed to me that a lesser verdict could have come, something like manslaughter or involuntary homicide or something like that. So that was the first thing. She was determined to punish herself, and I and my women friends were equally determined that she shouldn't be allowed to punish herself to that extent. And so that's why we asked for a voice, and very kindly was given a good voice in the media.
Mm. And it's an interesting case, isn't it, in terms of the way that you described Lorraine's plight, because I don't know, looking at many other cases of murder, and that's what it was, we'd be talking about Kaylee's 13-year-old, you know, happy, bubbly girl whose life was violently cut short.
Yep, that's right. But there are a number of cases, usually involving kids with disabilities or kids with particular difficulties, as Callis did have, and they often. There was a case quite premeditated of a woman who told her daughter to jump off the Fielding Bridge, and her daughter refused to, and so the mother strangled her with a pyjama cord, and that woman ended up spending about 2.5 years in prison, I think. She got a manslaughter verdict. And so the court does have compassion when it knows the story, but because Lorraine wasn't prepared to go through a trial, she didn't want to. She wanted to honour Callis. That's what she said. I want to honour Callis by pleading guilty. So the court was not going to get any chance to hear all the mitigating evidence. So that's why we shouted about it in the media.
Mm. Do you think this might change our perspectives when looking at these cases? It seems, as you say, you use the word compassionate. But I don't know. I mean, there will be many people out there today saying, well, how does this do justice to a young girl who was murdered?
Well, oddly enough, not a single person has actually said that to me, Alex. You know, I've been involved in a murder trial myself recently where two meth addicts killed a third meth addict who happened to be my grandson, you know, and you'll hear me rattle on for ages about the scourge of meth and so on and so forth, and, you know, and those two both got 16 and 17 year sentences. So I'm not against in murder cases a reasonable sentence, but it seemed to me that she was much more on the manslaughter end than the murder end. The other moral question, there's a really interesting moral question is here, if somebody did something and feels so terrible about it that basically she's prepared to sacrifice the whole rest of her life to honour the person that she killed and to give up her own chance of a voice. It's that sort of person we want cluttering up our prisons for, you know, 15, 20 years or whatever.
Yeah, it certainly shows remorse and clearly the judge took that into consideration. What are your concerns now, Liz, with her rehabilitation? You know, prison, as you inferred a little earlier, may not be the best place for someone who's suffering from depression and anxiety, as she'll be there for at least 6 years. What are your concerns for her now?
Well, I mean, there have been major gaps in the system in regard to that. However, the government has just put quite a lot of money into mental health care in the prisons as well as outside the prisons, you know, recognising that basically half all prisoners have mental health problems. And hopefully there'll be an improvement in those services in time to help Lorraine and others like her.
That's Dr. Liz Gordon on Checkpoint. The police will minimise their presence at Ihumato and have promised that there won't be a repeat of last Monday night when a tense standoff ensued with protesters. It's been just over 2 weeks since occupiers opposing a new housing development to the South Auckland site were served with eviction notice. County's Manukau District Commander Jill Rogers told RNZ this week that police had been told directly by protest organisers of their intention to breach protest lines on Monday and increase their numbers. But after meetings between the police deputy commissioner and protesters, they now say it was a miscommunication they don't want to happen again. Marnie Dunlop filed this for Thursday's Checkpoint program.
Tensions boiled over when police arrived on Monday night to block occupiers from moving further down Ihumatau Quarry Road. Police increased their numbers because they say they were told by organisers they planned to push past the cordon and reoccupy the land. Barta Soul representative Stephanie Tuffer said that was a huge miscommunication.
On the Monday evening, the communication came out that police thought that we intended to go and occupy Kaitiaki Village. That was never our intention. We didn't have any actions. I think some of you might have been here on that evening that we were doing that. We were actually hunkering down to cook dinner. It was really unexpected, but we've decided to move forward from that because we've agreed that we don't want that to happen again.
Wally Haumaha was welcomed onto Ihumatau on Tuesday night in an attempt to rebuild the trust between police and protesters. And after closed-door hui with protesters, he finally addressed media today, saying they will reduce numbers of police on the whenua and assign an officer to work alongside organisers.
We've got to a point now where we can minimise the police presence on this whenua and just maintain a small number around the health and safety for everyone. We've arrived at a good point to prevent any miscommunication that may have occurred in the past. And so to avoid that, we have appointed somebody to come along and sit alongside of our people, the organisers that are here, and we will continue to work together along those lines.
Wally Haumaha couldn't specify the exact numbers they would be reduced to. He also wouldn't address allegations that Soul organiser Pania Newton was pushed on Monday night, but says he has spoken to her and he wants to move forward. On Tuesday, protesters at the site felt the trust had been broken with the police, but Mana Whenua representative Haki Wilson says he believes after these face-to-face meetings, it's been restored.
Yes, I think so. I think it's been restored because, like Wally said, it's better to come kanohi ki te kanohi, kōrero I ngā kōrero, to make things better and to make things right for both parties. So I think, yeah, it's good.
Mr Wilson says he is certain that protesters will stick to the peaceful kaupapa.
We have been reinforcing our manaakitanga, make sure our tau te rangi Māori, our rongo is is within our campus, and that's our tikanga.
Seoul representative Stephanie Tuffer says they want to ensure they work well together with the police for all who stay and visit the land.
Moving from a position of them being here as enforcers, being here as part of the safety plan that we have, so how they'll be here will be our collaboration together on moving from what it has been to let's work for the safety.
Meanwhile, today, Ihu Mātou has hosted a range of groups, including tangata whenua from Hawaii, prominent lawyer Annette Sykes, and more than 100 Māori nurses.
Marnie Dunlop with that report from Checkpoint. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, a coroner has found a two-month-old baby likely died from drinking breast milk from her heavily intoxicated mother. And New Zealand women donate bras to support Pacific Sisters.
We collected 1,550 bras, 187 sets of togs, 82 pairs of underwear.
Still to come in The Week in Review. Thousands gathered Thursday at a rugby pitch in Masterton to farewell rugby great Sir Brian Lahore. The service was held on the Trust House Memorial Park rugby pitch he used to play on while the crowd sat in the Sir Brian Lahore stand. They heard tales of Sir Brian's life, his love not just of rugby but farming, his wife Pam and his three children. Laura Dooney went along to the funeral and filed this.
Lahore has broken, he's at standoff. This is Lahore.
As thousands gathered in the Sir Brian Lahore stand, on the pitch he'd played most of his games, the tributes began with footage of him as an All Black. While it was a solemn occasion, there were more laughs than tears, as close friends and family described the man Sir Brian, or BJ, was. Standing next to his father's casket, painted black and adorned with the All Black logo, son David Lahore told the crowd the rugby field was the best place for his father's funeral, in the heart of the people, in the place he loved most. He said it was important to remember BJ the man.
I've been pondering the order of BJ's passions in life, and one that keeps popping up is sheep. Slightly bemusing when you think you may figure lower in the pecking order than his beloved sheep. He was indeed a passionate and very talented farmer, and the quality of his stock was a source of great pleasure and pride to him.
He says his father, who'd requested a farmer's funeral, had a singular focus that was extraordinary to behold.
He was able to focus so completely on the task at hand that he could roll his motorbike on himself while grappling with a sheep in a flat paddock and not lose his grip on the animal.
He says his father had a passion for his grandchildren and was a mentor, confidant, but mostly he was their mate. David says their mother Pam was Sir Brian's everything.
She was his rock, his constant, his greatest supporter, his best friend, his passion. There's not enough words to describe that.
Close friend Ivan Grieve spoke about Sir Brian's love of golf and says throughout his life he gave a huge amount to New Zealanders.
I have often thought you would have made a great Governor General. You have been a great leader of men with high principles, always leading by example and setting giant standards. When you asked me to say a few words today, I was very honoured. Thank you, BJ, for being such an amazing New Zealander and a great mate.
And Gilbert Anoka, the All Blacks mental skills coach, says when he worked with Sir Brian, he told him Mr. Anoka was the shrink and Sir Brian was the bush psychologist. He says Sir Brian was an example of everything that is good in a person.
And he lived his life in a way that when people think of words like devotion, loyalty, integrity, inspiration and love, they will think of him.
Mr. Anoka says Sir Brian had a handshake like no other.
Hands as big as a plate, the grip firm and affirming. Watching him use a cell phone was a joy to behold. My bloody big fingers, you'd hear him say. So he tried to ring Pam or the kids back on the farm.
When the service ended, loved ones and former All Blacks Dan Carter, Richie McCaw, Michael Jones and John Kerwin formed a guard of honour for the hearse to drive through. A group of boys from Wairarapa College performed kamate as the hearse drove out onto the road. After the funeral, hundreds of people stayed behind, as requested by the family, to take advantage of the rural hospitality offered. Former All Black captain Richie McCaw was one. He says Sir Brian had good advice for him when he became captain in 2006.
He said, from what I can remember, you just need to do this, this and this and you'll be sweet as. And it was pretty calming from a guy who's been there and done that.
He says he feels very lucky to have spent time with such a great man. Judging by the crowd gathered in Masterton, Richie McCaw is one of thousands who have been touched in some way by Sir Brian Lahore.
Laura Dooney with that report from Thursday's Checkpoint program. The Cancer Society is welcoming news of funding for two new cancer drugs, but says delays have had huge costs for patients and their families. A slow negotiating process has meant some have died, while others have mortgaged their homes or spent their savings to get access to the drugs. One of the medicines, known as Kadcyla, is currently costing breast cancer sufferers at least $9,000 a month. Chris Jackson is medical director of the Cancer Society. He joined Susie Ferguson on Morning Report.
So on this, clearly you'll be happy that these have got funding, but is it clear why it's taken quite so long?
Well, no. We know that the application for Kadcyla or TDM1 has been with Pharmac for over 2 years, and New Zealand is characteristically very, very slow to review these applications and to come to a funding decision. And that time has a very real human cost. We know that people who've been campaigning for these drugs have missed out, and many have died during the time it's taken for Pharmac to make these decisions. And in the UK, they come to a yes-no decision within 90 days of application, at least that's the target, and there's no time frame that Pharmac has to follow a decision when they can get a good financial deal. And that means there's no certainty for patients. That means there's no clear or transparent process around that. And these things turn up a little bit unexpectedly sometimes.
And even now, the drug is going to be funded, but that's the key word in that sentence is going to be, or the phrase, because it's not going to be available till December anyway. There's still a time lag, even though it's got the tick.
We do need to have a period of implementation because we have to make sure that the hospitals have got the capacity and the nurses and the doctors to provide this. There will be a lead time in that. I'm not sure if that's to do with where the financial year falls or quite what, but there is always a lead time. I think patients will want that lead time to be as short as possible, so those who now have that news that the drug is going to be funded, that it has done so in the shortest space possible and the implementation phase is kept short. The other drug, alectinib, which is a lung cancer drug, also it's a tablet, so hopefully that will be able to brought on a little bit more quickly, even though that's been flagged as 1 December. Now, I just want to say as well, but this has been characterised by some people as a victory for campaigners, but this is actually very much Pharmac's business as usual. There's been no suggestion that I've heard that there's been political interference here or new money for Pharmac at all. This is the way Pharmac do business. They have had additional money created by the fact they've got less to spend on other drugs through price reductions. And it's really not to do with politics. It's just to do with the way Pharmac do business. And this is just going to happen again and again and again with every other drug that we see.
What about the way that Pharmac is funded, or perhaps the way that cancer drugs are funded specifically? The government says that its cancer plan is coming by the end of the month. Would you like to see money ring-fenced, separate from the Pharmac budget, as part of that plan that is something that will be able to be accessed so that when these new treatments come forward, New Zealanders are able to get them faster?
Our current model isn't serving cancer patients particularly well. Pharmac have got a very conservative investment model whereby they invest in drugs at a later stage than other countries and they take lower risks in terms of their investments than other countries do. But people with cancer have less time. They don't have time to wait while Pharmac make these decisions, 2 years for Kadcyla, and people die, and that is a very real human cost. Many countries are looking at this problem, and the UK have got a cancer drugs fund, which is an interim funding pool, whereby drugs with less clarity around the data can get across the line and funded for a temporary period while the data shores up to bridge that gap between the evidence coming out and there being enough evidence to get on the general schedule. And it would be good to see something done because we've seen over the last couple of years the people who've campaigned and turned up to select committees, we've heard their stories and we've seen their suffering is real. And people are cashing in their KiwiSavers, they're mortgaging their houses or they're foregoing treatment and dying sooner because they're not able to get access to these medicines. So it is complex.
That's the Medical Director of the Cancer Society, Chris Jackson, on Thursday's Morning Report. Christchurch residents who aren't able to live in their homes damaged by the massive Northwood gas explosion have received some good news. Christchurch City Council has voted to give them a roughly 50% discount on their rates. 3 weeks on from the explosion, at least 9 homes surrounding the epicentre of the blast have either limited access or cannot be entered at all by order of the council. Our reporter Conan Young filed this.
Graham Stewart's home backs onto the house where the explosion happened. He predicts he'll be out of his property for at least 6 months while it's repaired.
Ceilings have come down. Windows blown out, peculiarly because the explosion has sucked the windows out. Roofing tiles, which are concrete tiles from the house that was damaged, must have been thrown a fair altitude up in the air because they've come down and smashed into some of them straight through the ceilings inside the house.
Mr. Stewart is glad he'll now only be billed based on the value of his land, not the value of his land and house, representing a roughly 50% discount on his rates. He says it would have been unfair for the council to charge him the full amount on a home he couldn't live in.
We're not using sewerage from the property. We're not using basically services, I don't think we'll be getting rubbish collection there.
Today, the council agreed with Mr. Stewart and voted to open up a process for anybody out of their homes in Northwood to apply for a rebate on their rates. Ahead of the vote, the councillor representing Northwood, Aaron Kewen, said the same approach should be applied to anybody who is not able to live in their home.
No matter whether it's a flood, fire, explosion, anything else that could go wrong, I don't want to name the others and jinx the city any more than it is should not pay rates. If you've got something that you cannot use, you should not be paying a tax on it.
Mayor Leanne Dalzell made reference to an earlier staff recommendation to reject any rates relief for Northwood residents.
I know that this paper, probably just its publication, would have caused some concern in the community and probably anxiety as well.
Councillor Jamie Gough said the rebate was the right thing to do.
This is very similar to the earthquake-affected rates remission. Charging people rates on the improvement value of their homes when they literally no longer have one would be heartless and illogical.
Graham Stewart says as a super annuitant, every little bit counts. He says he'll use the money to help pay for the temporary accommodation he's living in while his home is repaired.
Conan Young with that report from Thursday's Checkpoint program. A new UN report says the West's high consumption of meat and dairy produce is fueling climate change. One of the report's authors, Lincoln University's Anita Reeford, says farmers should take heart that the report recognises livelihoods depend on agriculture production. But Beef and Lamb New Zealand reject that, saying cutting back on fossil fuels is the single biggest challenge. Jeremy Baker is the chief insight officer at Beef and Lamb. He joined Corin Dan on Friday's morning report.
We've heard from a number of the scientists involved in this report. They're pretty adamant that agriculture needs to change and that the report doesn't say we should all become vegans, but it does suggest cutting back on meat is one way to help. Do you agree?
No, the report is aimed at high emissions food production systems that clear forests and use land that could otherwise be used for low producing food production systems. And look, the New Zealand red meat production system is already, as they are say in the report, we want animal source protein that's resilient, sustainable and low GHG emission. That's already what we've got.
So we don't need to make any further changes?
Well, we've already reduced in the red meat sector our emissions by 30% since 1990, and we're committed to adding no additional warming and becoming climate neutral by 2050. So yes, we do have to do more work, but we're also the hosts of 1.4 million hectares of native forest on our sheep and beef farms, which is sequestering a huge amount of carbon. Those are all good things.
And you're right, the report does note that New Zealand is leading the way in some regards, but it doesn't change the fact that the report and other reports say are telling the world, the consumer, to eat less meat. So the message for your industry is a difficult one, right? That people should eat less meat. That's one good way for anybody to cut their emissions.
Well, the message from our industry is eat quality food and eat low emissions food. And that is, we have a huge march on the rest of the world in terms of our production system. So this is not necessarily bad for New Zealand's production system.
Is your message that people should eat less meat?
No, our message is that people should eat what the report and all the other reports have said, which is a balanced diet. And there are some people in the world, some parts of the Western world, where people are eating too much fat, salt and meat, but not in New Zealand, and that's not what we recommend. We recommend the right amount of meat, good quality meat, from a low-producing system as part of a balanced diet.
But that may be the case, but you are fighting here now a global movement, a global argument that's coming from the UN that's telling people to eat less meat. This is a serious threat to the industry, isn't it?
I think as long as people don't understand that what the UN is saying is don't eat high GHG producing foods, then yes. But we can explain to the world, and that we've already started that process, that we are part of that solution. We are producing low emissions food from a natural environment on land that actually can't be used for other food production systems. That's another big focus of this report, is trying to free up land for other food production.
Well, let me pick you up on the idea that we're a low emissions. I know that you're making a lot of effort to mitigate, mm-hmm. but as we heard from one of the scientists earlier this morning, because we're grass-fed, right?
Yep.
The cows and beef are mm-hmm. out there roaming the fields, that's nice, but there's no way to capture those emissions, is there?
No. What we have to do is do two things. One, reduce our emissions per kilo of meat produced, and we have to offset them. And that's why the 1.4 million hectares of native forest that is sequestering carbon, not just for 30 years like the exotic forests that are going to be used for offsetting fossil fuel emissions. These sequester
sure,
carbon.
But the problem you've got, right, as an industry, if you're marketing that you're mitigating in best practice, but if you're up against farmers overseas that are capturing the emissions by putting them inside barns or whatever, then that's a problem for us, isn't it?
But those food production systems are using vast amounts of water, vast amounts of grain that's on land that actually could be going to human consumption. And that's actually the core focus of the IPCC report, is actually on how do we use the land most efficiently. And New Zealand sheep and beef production land is not available for other food production systems. And given that we've got sequestration for about 80% of our emissions now, I think we've got really on target to actually hitting our being climate neutral by 2050.
Is the meat industry arguing the science here? Or is it
no, we're not arguing the science.
You're accepting it, right?
We're accepting the science. We are absolutely committed to doing our part on climate change. But what we're saying is we are a very different production system from most production systems in the world, and we have a very secure place in the future food production system of the world.
Right, so the challenge, I'll just finish up, I'll come back to the point. The challenge for the New Zealand meat industry is the public relations, but it's your ability to get your message out.
Absolutely.
Against other countries.
Absolutely.
Which are also going to be doing the same thing. That is a big risk to New Zealand, right?
It's a big challenge, and we're up for it.
The Chief Insight Officer at Beef and Lamb, Jeremy Baker, on Morning Report. A coroner has found a two-month-old baby likely died from drinking breast milk from her heavily intoxicated mother. Sapphire Williams died in January 2017. Our reporter Kate Gudsall has been reading the report. She joined Susie Ferguson on Morning Report.
Tell us about Sapphire.
Morning, Susie. Well, it's a very sad case. Sapphire was a twin. She was premature. She was born at 33 weeks. So she had existing health issues. And she was one of seven children. The family had kids ranging from the two-month-old twins up to 6 years old. And they were actually homeless at the time of her death. They were waiting for Housing New Zealand to assign them a house, but they were staying with family. So the health follow-ups that Sapphire needed didn't happen. She also needed iron and vitamin C medication, but hadn't had that for 2 weeks prior to her death. And the report also concluded that there was a dangerous sleeping environment because there were numerous children in the bed.
Yeah, tragic case, as you're saying, Kate. What actually happened?
Well, the mother, Janice Tour, predominantly formula-fed Sapphire, but she said in the lead-up to the death, Sapphire had woken up in the early hours of the morning, so she had breastfed her while she was waiting for the formula to cool down. But 2 days prior to the night that Sapphire died, she had been drinking at her cousin's house, and she thinks she would have drunk around 18 cans of pre-mixed bourbon and cola over a day. She said that she'd felt hungover, but it wasn't a bad hungover, she said. And the toxicologist's report found that there was a high level of alcohol in Sapphire's system, when it would have been the equivalent of more than six times the legal blood alcohol limit for driving. And the mother, Ms. Tua, admitted it was likely the high level of alcohol in Sapphire's system would have come from her breast milk, basically.
That's our reporter Kate Gudsall on Friday's Morning Report. Tiny house owners are clashing with authorities over what they say are unfair and inconsistent regulations. With no specific legislation for tiny houses, some councils are treating them as structures that need full building code compliance and others as vehicles under the Land Transport Act. Katie Todd filed this.
Allendale's Amberley Beach tiny house is his own personal slice of paradise. It's a fantastic lifestyle. Look, I'm totally off-grid. I don't get any electric bills. The sun provides all my energy. It's just a nice, cheap way of living, you know, clutter-free, mess-free, and affordable. You know, I built my tiny house. I built everything myself, done everything. And I've not even broken $37,000 yet.
But that affordability is looking less certain. Although Mr. Dow's tiny house is on wheels and can be towed, Hiranui District Council says it's a building, not a vehicle. It issued him with a notice to fix last year, meaning he has to remove or demolish his house, or he'd have to spend thousands of dollars fixing the house to the ground and connecting it to the grid in order to comply with the building code. Mr. Dow didn't think that was fair, so approached the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment for a determination, hoping officials would agree his home is a vehicle, which is how other councils treat tiny houses. But MB sided with Hiranui District Council, so Mr. Dow is taking MB to court to overthrow the determination.
And we're going to show them all the previous determinations, and the judge will say, well, if this is a determination for one, why can't it be the same determination for all these others?
Down the road in Rangiora, another North Canterbury tiny housemaker is vowing to fight what he calls the bureaucracy gone mad of Waimakariri District Council. Eco Cottages owner Colin Whiteman says he's been warned by the council and is expecting a notice to fix, which he says would force him to stop making houses due to the cost of compliance. But Mr. Whiteman has sold about 85 tiny houses on wheels and says he's bewildered why some councils are welcoming them while others are clamping down on his customers.
Some councils have been wonderful and accommodating tiny houses both in holiday parks and on private property. So I guess the councils at the moment that I'm looking at, I'm guessing they're talking with one another, is Waimakariri, Hiranui and Tasman. Marlborough in between, they've been semi-accommodating and understanding. So yeah, that's a concern in itself when you see an inconsistency in the way that they're actually applying the law.
In a statement, the Waimakariri District Council's Manager of Regulation, Nick Carrison, says until the Building Act offers greater clarity around tiny houses, building consent authorities need to continue their role, making sure new builds are up to minimum safety standards. He says the eco-cottages are a great concept, and the council wants to make sure they are safe and sound for those who want to live in them. Mr. Whiteman says all eyes are on Alan Dow's court case, which will be a landmark for the future of tiny house owners across New Zealand. The matter has also been taken to Parliament by Green MP Gareth Hughes.
They're an innovative solution to the housing crisis. I think they really tap into that Kiwi ideal that you can actually build your own home. So we need to make sure there's a clear space that they can be built if that's what people want.
His ideas were welcomed in Parliament by Building and Construction Minister Jenny Salisa, who is in the process of analysing the Building Act.
I'm open to considering all options regarding the kinds of buildings that the member has described. I agree that the government should investigate all options for innovative solutions to the housing crisis.
Mr. Hughes says tiny house owners shouldn't be burdened with compliance costs they can't afford. And he says the government shouldn't be providing workarounds by letting people slap wheels on structures and call them a vehicle. Mr. Dow and MB officials will attend a preliminary hearing next month when a formal court date will be set. MB did not respond to requests for comment.
Katie Todd with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint program. A Dunedin surveyor who thinks the city's Baldwin Street was robbed of the world's steepest title plans to travel halfway across the world in an attempt to claim it back. Dunedin man Toby Stoff was the first to cry foul when Baldwin Street was stripped of its title, and now he's going to Harlech, Wales to put his theory to the test. Our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown has the story.
It was the news heard around the world. Well, the surveying world. Dunedin's Baldwin Street, the steepest in the world for the past three decades, was ceding its title to Fforddiadh Penllyrch in the Welsh town of Harlech. But to Toby Stoff, something seemed off, and he was proved right when Guinness World Records confirmed the Welsh record was measured at the inside verge of a curve, exaggerating the gradient. He's been up to Baldwin Street and taken some quick measurements, which have re-proven what's already known about Dunedin's contender.
I think the first survey was done back in the 1980s. I mean, we're able to do it a little bit more accurately now. I think I got something like 34.6 7% at the steepest off the top of my head. So within a, you know, within Kiwi of the 35%, not a million miles away.
He says with the assistance of Global Survey, a complete scan of Baldwin Street will be taken tomorrow, giving the most accurate picture of the street yet. Thanks to some behind-the-scenes string-pulling, the same will happen with Fortith Penclough, and then the world and Guinness World Records can make up their mind.
I'm going to go over and survey it as well. Then I'll probably do a comparison. I can do like two profiles, just plot one on top of the other. And I'll just say, look, there's a centreline profile of both streets. I'm not going to say anything after that. I said, well, you guys be the judge. But I think once we've got all that information through, then it's in the public realm. Guinness can either say yay or nay.
Mr. Stoff says he's pretty confident the final picture will demonstrate Baldwin Street as the rightful holder to the claim of world's steepest street. So you're pretty confident the centreline measurements are going to show Baldwin Street to be the far steeper street?
Well, on the centreline, yeah. I mean, they're better. If they don't, I'm going to look like a bit of a chump. But that's, as I understand it, the Welsh Street was measured on the steepest part was measured on the inside of the curve. By the time you get out onto the centreline, it should be a lot flatter. Hey, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's really steep on the centreline as well. But, you know, until we actually take the measurements and compare them, there's no way of knowing, really.
And he's found some supporters in his former surveying school classmates who hatched the plan to send him to Wales and have so far raised about $5,000 to make it happen. Mike Constable, who's now based in Singapore, told Checkpoint they are preparing for the backlash which may come when they contest the record.
Toby has been in touch with the surveyor in Wales, so we expect him to be on the ground when Toby's there. Concerned about Toby getting a few leaks thrown at him and things like this, so we're going to outfit him with some protective equipment.
Mr. Constable and another classmate, Dave Mitchell, started the online fundraising effort with former classmates and were now reaching out to others in the surveying world. Mr. Mitchell says claiming the record back for Dunedin is about righting a wrong.
I haven't been there, Mike hasn't been there, Toby hasn't been there, but looking at it, it's photographs and street view, etc. It's a bit of a lane, isn't it? It's hardly what I would call a proper street. And I think that a visit over there and a few measurements and stuff will expose it for what it is, a bit of a sham.
The pair are aiming to raise more than $10,000 and are hoping to send Mr. Stoff to Harlech sometime in October when Gwyn Headley, the man behind the Fortith Penclough record, will be in town.
Our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown with that report from Tuesday's Checkpoint programme. Forget burning them. Bras donated by New Zealand women are giving their sisters in the Pacific a new sense of freedom. More than 1,500 bras collected by women's networks and two government departments have been donated to the Uplift Project, supporting women of the Pacific Islands who have never owned a bra. Our reporter Charlotte Cook joined them on Tuesday as they did the final count.
That's the sound of one of countless boxes packed full of bras being taped up, ready to go to Fiji, for women eager to holster the girls. A charity called the Uplift Project has been collecting and distributing bras and underwear to women in remote areas, giving them access to a properly fitted, good quality bra. For many women in the Pacific, a bra can be their ticket to freedom. Women's networks at the Ministry of Justice and ACC set themselves a goal of collecting 1,000 bras, but they've racked up hundreds more.
We collected 1,550 bras, 187 sets of togs, 82 pairs of underwear, one sports top, 7 sets of nursing pads, and 3 bra extenders to a total of 1,830 items. Yeah.
The Ministry of Justice's Belinda Waters says the idea to start a collection was sparked by something many women will identify with, a wardrobe full of new or barely used bras.
The thing that really got me was that a lot of these women will never own another bra in their lives. This is the only one they'll ever get. And for us, we have so many, to just realise that there's people out there that, you know, really need it and we can really help with that. It's just amazing.
Ms. Waters says she's amazed with the mountain of donations and the efforts which people went to. One man even gave them money to buy some new ones because he didn't fancy braving the world of lingerie but wanted to be involved. The Uplift Project's New Zealand coordinator, Pauline Watson, says since 2012, New Zealand women have sent around 50,000 bras to Tonga, Samoa, Fiji and Vanuatu, but demand is always growing. She says without a bra, some women of the Pacific Islands can't be employed. Nursing mothers don't leave the house because they're leaking, and schoolgirls stop playing sport without the support.
some households in the islands, you know, they have one bra between five women. And so whoever has the appointment or has to go to town that day gets bra. They have to share it. So forget about sizing. So often, Uplift, it's the only bra they've ever had in their life.
Ms. Watson says the bras give women an important sense of freedom and empowerment. Mary Kalsrap works in Vanuatu, visiting remote villages to rehome the bras. She says the women who receive them are extremely happy and overwhelmed with their newfound freedom.
They can go to church, like to have a new bra, or they can go out to public meetings to share their ideas, because when they didn't have bras, they were afraid to go out to communities and do community work, but when they have a good bra, they can go out to do the community work, going to church on Sundays, meetings with the other groups of women in the community.
The women from Ms. Kalsrap's village who have received bras wanted to give something back as a thank you for the support. They had nothing to give but their voices.
Our reporter Charlotte Cook with that report from Checkpoint. And finally, in the Week in Review, it stood up to a metre high, weighed about 7 kilograms, and had a beak capable of cracking open other birds. The world's largest parrot, dubbed Squawkzilla, once wandered terrain deep in the heart of the Maniototo in central Otago. Evidence of what's called a truly gigantic parrot has been found by scientists from Australia and New Zealand among 19-million-year-old fossils. Tracy Neal has the story.
Long ago, the part of New Zealand where these birds lived was lush, tropical and warm. The discovery of Heracles inexpectatus, named for its Herculean myth-like size and strength, has made these scientists the world's first to find an extinct giant parrot. Professor Sue Han from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, who is part of the discovery team, says it's an exciting find.
This is an extraordinary find. It's not something that we expected. This whole site, you know, the St. Bathans site in South Island of New Zealand, is pretty significant. It fills a big gap in the fossil record.
The New Zealand fossil is about twice the size of the critically endangered flightless New Zealand kakapo, previously the largest known parrot. A senior curator of natural history at the Canterbury Museum says the clues lie in the few bones found. Paul Schofield says they believe the giant parrot to be related to the kia, the kaka, and the kakapo.
So we've got two of the leg bones, and the legs are more than twice the size of a kakapo, so that makes us very confident that what we're dealing with is a giant kakapo-like bird.
News of the discovery broke this morning, and it didn't take long to reach the ears of the Rewalka-based Tasman Parrot Club. Founder Brent Marshall says the club would have been thrilled to have had something like a giant parrot wandering around today.
Quite amazing, really. I mean, kakapo being the largest, it's like having the harsed eagle around, but he's on the ground.
While a picture is now forming of what it might have looked like, how it might have sounded is anyone's guess. But Mr. Marshall says it would have been loud.
Well, kakapo's quite a noisy little guy. Kia and kaka are both quite noisy little fellows as well. So I would imagine it would be quite noisy. It wouldn't be a screech, I wouldn't think, more of a kakapo boom sort of thing.
He says millions of years ago, New Zealand would have been like a massive aviary with few predators. Mr. Schofield says it's one reason New Zealand is known for its fat and flightless giant birds. An associate professor at Flinders University, Trevor Worthy, says in some ways the find is not surprising.
New Zealand had more than its fair share of giant birds. It has had the greatest diversity of what we call avian giants for any landmass in the world. And now we can add to that the first instance of a giant parrot.
Professor Worthy says the latest find is likely to excite global interest.
On two levels, we've got, you know, a giant parrot, which parrots are clever things. You can imagine what an animal approaching a metre tall might have done if it was in a car park in a ski field. It adds another whole group of birds that had the propensity to become avian giants.
Professor Sue Hand says while they can chart how the parrots arrived and thrived in the location, why they didn't survive is a mystery. But it may be linked to the changing climate and its impact on food source.
What we're learning from that period in New Zealand is that it was much warmer than it is today. So vegetation probably a little bit different, including things like palms and laurels.
Squawkzilla is estimated to have had a beak big enough to crack wide open anything it fancied, perhaps even other parrots. Brent Marshall of the Tasman Parrot Club says evidence that our native birds have a taste for meat exists today.
Pukeko and weka all eat other animals. You know, they're great rat and mouse hunters, those fellas. So you've got to be quite careful when you lay poison if there's those kind of birds around.
Professor Worthy says Heracles is a spectacular find, but it's likely the site hasn't yet yielded all its secrets.
Our Nelson Marlborough reporter Tracy Neal with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint programme. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next programme will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki. Have a great week.